is currently April 16th, and the time is 8 a.m. And the Betty Davis Park Garden will have to say capital, and the sun is out shining. Now, others present are with
school of
it's not that our school district completely lost our student count prior to the pandemic.
Outside of entities, families, and any other family groups to help make that successful for our students. In terms of meal distribution, our food service program, we have been following the waiver process from the USDA, and so we've actually been delivering or distributing over 2,000 meals a week for students. Now, our school population is just under 300 this year. Our ABM was at 288. And we're accustomed to about 325 to 330 in terms of our enrollment. So our brick and mortar enrollment is down about 15 to 19% this year. And we do have a correspondence program, although it really doesn't compare to some of the other state correspondence programs. And of course, Fairbanks being a bigger district and having a longer history with their correspondence program, we really can't compare that way. But we've had about 30 students leave the brick and mortar this year, 25 of whom enrolled in our correspondence program, and between 5 and 10 or so have selected other correspondence programs in the state. So we have in-person schooling Monday through Thursday for the students, and then on Fridays, we have opportunities for students to come to school and work in small groups and cohorts, or work individually with teachers and paraprofessionals, either on remedial types of things that they may need in place, or enrichment opportunities and activities for students. Students take field trips on Fridays and get outside and explore the local Cordova area. We've also had sports and activities this year, but we haven't had any student travel or any staff travel. So our focus this year with engaging kids in after-school activities has been really on skill building and concepts around what it means to be on a team, what it means to be resilient in the face of adverse conditions and so forth. So that's really been our approach to trying to maintain some sense of normalcy, but at the same time, keeping everybody safe. So I'm happy to stop there and answer any questions.
Well, I think we'll go on to school getting good news. Welcome, and what does the school look like in the life of daily schools?
Good morning, Madam Chair, and members of the Board of Education Committee. I'm Scott McDowell, Superintendent for Alaska Gateway School District. I've been in Alaska Gateway for 22, 23 years. I've been superintendent for the last 5, and I'm 5th year right now. In the spring of 2020, when the governor shut the schools down, we must have school. All of our schools, we designed an operations conflict department to do a lot of firm and service that went almost 3 weeks. And when we started up, the idea that we had implemented in the summer that we worked through the summer on was that we would be able to move into and out of the schools with fair amount of seamlessness, that we made sure that all of our kids had computers that they could get home. We worked on getting internet, and when the pandemic started, we had about 50% of our homes had internet, and then right now we're sitting at probably pretty close to 98%. We worked with our local ISP, we had a couple of them because we're a large district in terms of geography. So we worked with our local ISP, US Department of Health, and we came up with a negotiation with them. We came up with a plan where they subsidized internet into the homes, and we paid for a portion of that. We paid for more of that outcome. So we paid for more of that for families that are special education that have high needs. And that's worked quite well, because we've been able to get basic internet into practically every home in the district for essentially free. They want higher bandwidth, and there's a cost there, and a number of families can afford that. And that's a program that I understand AP&T has since taken to new run. So we spooled up, and then you can move into and out of the tech, you can move into and out of staff those would be used the start plan that the department developed, and basically put our schools into that model, and using that model, we had schools move into and out of classrooms. We had, some cases in the community. We've had no cases since the start began. We've had no cases of in-school transmission that we are aware of. And we, like Superintendent Rustin, we looked at our trip back to mitigation that we put into place with students wearing masks, staff wearing masks, depending on their status. But also, I worked really hard to get testing. So we've had testing in the district since November. The bottom line of testing, I think that's been critical since then. Because we have random testing and standard testing for certain situations, we've brought a number of cases before we have gotten into the school population. It's helped us to stay open. But what we learned in the fall was that that plan wasn't working. Kids weren't very responsive. Contact between homes was difficult. Teachers were spending time on their phone to try to get, trying to talk to kids, trying to Zoom with kids. In spite of the internet, the bandwidth that we got, to do Zoom was more fun. So those kinds of things, when we reevaluated, we were constantly reevaluating how things were working. And what we found was that, just because people had the ability, they didn't always use it. So in the middle of from late fall, we recalled again. And we had one of our schools, Eagle School, had taken the APPSES training. And they were using that, and they were being successful. And we dropped them, and that's how they were, that particular school was functioning, and it was doing quite well. They were getting good response. They had good protocols set up. And so, after we came to the conclusion that the blended virtual learning program that we designed wasn't working, the faculty had a choice. You can continue on with something you know isn't working, or you can retool. And so we retooled. We asked again for the department to give us more time to train, and later in January we had a bigger in-service that we spooled up with more of a personalized learning approach. Largely using APSES trials. Not all schools did that. Those that did have been pretty successful. So that's been really useful. To answer, in the long version of getting to the questions last week, but because we caught them, we caught it with our screen, and we're able to work with our native health people here. We're able to get them out of school, and because of COVID, we don't really got it, you know, how it came about, because we were able to get them out of the school, and we're able to stay with them. And we've had a number of instances where that has been the case. So the testing has been really critical for us. We have a sports program for basketball this year, for example. We have very well. We just have a standing rule that we test all of our players every week and before games, and any teams that we play get tested. And teams who, we've had teams refuse to test, and then we just don't play them. And, you know, it's been a while, and hopefully we can schedule something for next year. We have a bunch of different kids, but I'm pretty adamant that that's been a successful approach. So right now, we have 95% of our families having their students in school. They have managing testing, and we're essentially running, I wouldn't say normally, but fairly normally. You know, we still do have visitors allowed into the school. We can test them when they come in, and they still have to wear masks and maintain distance. But we've had a number of presentations that we're able to have in the gym. We've had, right now, we're gearing up for an in-school basketball tournament, for example, trying to, because the basketball season was mitigated, and that's really important to our kids. So we're trying to do an in-district tournament, and we're running type of programs to keep our kids eligible and still focus on learning, and that's been a strong motivator. And so that's where I'm at, and open to any questions. The Alaska Virtual School that the department started last, the education department provided last year, provided training for, and we had staff go and attend that training. One of the interesting things we learned about it was that it was, it's a lot of work for teachers to do that program. A lot of work to make it work. It's not the kind of a program where you can just turn kids on the computer and tell them have fun and good luck with that. It takes a lot of work on the teacher side to facilitate the learning, to set up the hands-on activities to make it meaningful. But what we did do, what we did figure out is what it does work in, you know, if you do it correctly. And so we've been spending time on that. And I think our test scores that we use map testing right now when the little kids, I'm sure the community knows, I would say, unfortunately, we're being beat because I'm not. I don't see personally what the benefit of it is, and I think the role of educators in my district would agree with that. But map testing is very important to us, and it helps us to retool and design instruction to meet individual needs. And so that program, Alaska SES, but the department, has been very helpful to us in maintaining student fidelity to a curriculum. The students are able to take their computer home, they're able to access it from home, they're able to get help at school, they're able to get, you know, in-person lessons at school. And so it's a hybrid system that, especially for our small schools, I have two schools that are one teacher and two schools that are two teacher schools, and then we have three teacher schools, and six teacher schools, and I think it's an 18-teacher school. So in our very small schools, that's been super helpful for us, and it's made a big difference in terms of fidelity to curriculum and consistency, and even though kids are in and out of the school sometimes, it has made a big difference for us.
Questions, I'm going to have to talk about another topic of the course. or skilled needs. Let's start with Captain Preston. What are you seeing as some of the greatest needs of your students at this point in the school year?
Well, thank you for the question and the topic. So, at a recent school board meeting, our state representative said, we need more time. And there was a little bit of laughter, and the board member kind of asked about, does that mean in the current schedule or in the normal school day? And of course, the response was in the current schedule. But we have a vision, I have a vision here, and it's maybe a little bit lofty, but that students are at the doors in the morning, banging on the doors, asking for the school to be open. And it's taken a pandemic to reach that, to do that. We have kids lined up outside the doors in the morning because they need to be here. They need to be in school. They need the interaction with their friends. They need the support and the stability of the school schedule. They need that interaction with their teachers and school staff. So, tied to that, of course, is our social and emotional learning needs. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we probably have noticed, even though we've been blessed to have daily in-person school. We all know it's not usable, it's not normal, and kids are really finding the need to have some sense of normalcy in their lives. And I think in a small community like Cordova, the school district plays a critical role in helping to meet not only the academic needs of students, of course, but those social emotional needs as well. So our district is just in the early stages of training about 10 of our 60 staff members in a social emotional learning framework, and we're working with the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence and their social emotional framework. And so we're excited at that opportunity. And we will eventually, at the early start of the school year next year, pull in community members and families and key individuals in the community to also get that training so that they can support students both in and out of the school context. So I think that that's what we're finding the biggest need for students is to continue providing stability for them as we wrap up the school year and really look at emotionally and socially supporting the kids. In terms of, I'll just maybe move on to the next question that you posed, plans for addressing learning loss and credit recovery for students at risk, or maybe those who are not graduating. We have a pretty small graduating class this year of 17 students, 17 seniors. And actually, three of the seniors finished all of their credits at the end of the first semester. So those students have moved on, and they will come back to participate in graduation ceremony, but they have either moved on to employment or are taking a little bit of time off before they start further schooling in the fall. But in terms of credit recovery and learning loss for at-risk students, at the high school, junior and senior high school, we have an early warning system that we've deployed, and that focuses in on the area of attendance, behavior, and course grades. So we call it the ABC, EWS, the ABC early warning system. But again, staff, after fingertips, the principal, school office personnel, they can look at that early warning system and identify students who are sort of, maybe moving a little bit further down the line in terms of support, again, with attendance, behavior, and course performance or their course grades. In terms of learning loss, that's a term that I'm uncomfortable with, partly because I think that there is a broad assumption that all students have lost a year of schooling, and that's not true. That's not the fact. Certainly, things haven't been normal any student in the U.S. or in the world even, but we have to assess the notion of learning less and ask ourselves, has it actually happened, and if so, to what degree? So, you know, we have metrics and measurements and some systems in place to ask ourselves that question, to reflect on the data that we do have. We use MAP data in our elementary school, and those outcomes on our fall and winter assessments show that they are extremely comparative to previous years under normal circumstances. And so the results of those fall well within the range of the national norms for MAP scores. So again, we are constantly in a state of trying to do better, trying to help our students achieve just a little bit more. But again, that notion of learning less, we take with a real cautious approach, I suppose, because we don't want to get caught up in the rhetoric that every student has lost a year's worth of learning. So maintaining context within those realms is important to us as we continue to further assess what the needs of our kids are. But to summarize, I suppose, again, the social emotional learning needs are something that we're really paying attention to and we have throughout the year, and know that it will be important next year to also pay attention to those. So where is your district even using capsule models for the rest of the universities in Seattle for creating change in the school culture and school climate, learning climate? So that's been something that we're doing just as a matter of course. But I would say that it's taken on a new importance for us. We are fortunate that we have money right now that allows us to have an extra cost on our staff, which was, we're planning for a pandemic, but we had to plan for one that would have been one of the first things we did. Because I would say the school and all the things that are every day in the school are suddenly different and big things. We've had things that are typically close to problems, students, sometimes even families turning to things that are larger, disproportionately more important than they would normally take on. And I think because of the stress of the pandemic, there is some economic stress, of course, that ripples through the social fabric of any community. And so we've had challenges, and I think we've grown largely in that spectrum. I would agree with fellow comments about Ross Brown. I've heard a lot about Ross Brown. I know about it. I think there are a lot of people who feel pretty strongly about it, but I'm not seeing that. I'm not seeing that in my test scores, which are, they were definitely up a little bit, not off the charts, but and I've asked my staff where they're, of the match forms, and that's why I'm seeing this increase. It's because I think it's not abnormal, but it's surprising. And I was not expecting that, to be honest. And the comments I got were that, kids are trying. The kids that are trying are trying. Not all kids test either, so that's a thing that we're still getting our heads around. Is, that's what I'm saying to them. Broadcast because state law, of course, allows them to opt out. So, but of the students who did test, we've seen an increase. The response is not because everybody's working harder. many of us, especially when we have anxiety, have not had any kind of meaningful friends or since this began. And we're looking forward to the end of the tunnel. I would say that, so counseling is an issue. Kids need to be in school. They need to be in school. We're seeing that becoming more and more, it's becoming more and more important. They need the social structure. They want to be in school. I'm not as fortunate as Superintendent Ruskin is to have kids banging on the door outside of any crap, but I can tell you that they want to be there. And, we have, and they come. And we have after school activities. We have very strict rules around that. Like I said, we have been encouraging sports, which was huge. And a very badly supported community, obviously. And in spite of the fact that we have wide, we have a wide range of views about the whole pandemic, we have people who think this is, the whole thing is better and complete nonsense and are angry about it. And we have other people who think that we should be hiding in our closets and are angry that we're not completely locked down. And so we have this wide range of points of view that I think superintendents across the state are trying to balance and trying to, thread that needle, as it were. We have a way of support from, we learn about what other districts need, what other students need, in part because of our communication with other districts. Between, that's one of the things that I've heard throughout this is, there's, I think, great communication. In the last part facility, right, the last student association, for example, where we have had a great, this thing started out, we were meeting sometimes almost daily, and then transition to a couple times a week, and then transition to a week, and right now we meet once every other week. And it's been very good, and I have been really glad that it's been settling down a little bit, I feel like it has. And that camaraderie, that relationship that we have between the superintendents has been, I think, super critical for us to maintain a direction to kind of get an idea when we might be steering off course a little bit. I'm not speaking for myself, but that relationship that's been a part of that organization has been really critical. One of the things that I think came out has been discussed is this obvious issue of equity and health. And we are planning to address the equity and health issue as best we can, largely through internet access. And so, with respect to the online system that we're using, but what that's really done is change and make a computer into a textbook that we can track where a student is and what they're learning so we don't have these calls in there. But it has not, it's exacerbated the need for a teacher, and it's made the job of a teacher significantly more difficult because you can't often, sit down and have a regular class with your students because they are all in different places in their content. So, we've been able to target our assistance to them, tailor it to them. Their assessments. I guess we'll talk about learning loss and better recovery in the next round.
Thank you for those comments. And I just wanted to comment that we at the Board of Education take care of the world. We appreciate how hard staff has been working and the stress and the responsibility you feel for your students and your families. So thank you on our behalf. And then to note to Superintendent Pickwick, what are you seeing as some of the greatest things that your students have been taught about this pandemic year?
I think that, reiterating what you were saying, I'm going to try to, of course,
So, early
So, and then the other thing that we're doing is, we've been doing this anyway, over, I think, folks who are intentionally is, you know, we have a high percentage of indigenous population, Alaska Native population in our district. And so we are really working on using the subsistence, typical soil subsistence gathering kinds of activities to incorporate that into the academic or the test place of school. For example, we're doing a festival project working with the National Park System in the same rise. So we'll be taking our kids down to for a week-long camp down on the Copper River when the rides start running in the summer. And we'll be doing fisheries biology. We'll have scientists from the park come and work with our kids. We'll be fulfilling their curricular requirements in biology, but also learning about, you know, storing and keeping fish and using a fish grower and camp life and the kinds of things that are important in the village. That's really helped us, I think, when, you know, when I've talked with the village leadership about how we want to help their kids. They're very motivated in this area. They want to know that their kids are not actually just their parents. They want their students to learn. And so that's a short version of how we're approaching them. Yes, thank you, Caleb. So it's our intent to offer two different summer school sessions this year. The first is scheduled to take place near the end of May and a few weeks into June. And we'll focus on our migrant education students during that particular session. And then later in sort of the tail end of July and into the first few weeks of August before school starts, we intend to have sort of a boot camp type of summer school program for students, and we're able to use some federal funds programmatically for that. And we're going to pay particular attention to our incoming kindergarten groups of students. We have a fairly large class, probably almost 40 kindergarten students coming in, and they did not unfortunately have the benefit of our pre-K this year. We usually run a district-funded pre-K program, and just based on the scheduling and staffing this year, we were unable to do that. So we want to pay attention to those early learners coming into the building next year.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair Grumman, to the committee members. We have about 30% of our student population that qualifies as migrant students, and so based on the federal guidance and sort of the Alaska migrant program, students either do subsistence or migrant types of activities outside of Cordova. And sometimes that means going out on a boat and fishing for a period of time. The students have to spend at least 7 days and 7 nights, not consecutive, but throughout the course of the year, really, doing those types of activities that are helping to provide for their homes. Students also berry pick and gather other sorts of sustenance that they need throughout the year. So those are the primary activities, again, going outside of the community, away from the community for periods of time to help meet their family needs.
Thank you. as our school finances. And so I started thinking about finding the superintendent at first meeting, and I'm thinking of the superintendent at first. What does your district stand financially?
So we had the good fortune of, I think, that when the pandemic happened, that a lot of our families moved back from the city. They moved with our families who lived in Fairbanks and Anchorage and Westmore, and when the pandemic hit, they moved home. So we were, on our estimated student enrollment, we were within a couple of students. So that didn't hurt us. As expected, we did have a bump in enrollment. We have a small program, and we did have a bump in that, so about 10% increase in that. But we still struggle financially. You know, we have been flat-funded, as you well know, for a number of years, and every year of flat-funding for us costs another $100,000 to $200,000 for us. And so, so we're down $700,000 to $1 million in terms of our buying power. We are, because we're a small district, we have really had to focus on getting grants and things that we do. Most of the things that I've talked about that are going to be important to learn properly have not been able to be financed out of our general rate. Thank you. Yes, thank you for the question, Kutcher. So we are a city school district and rely on local contributions for part of our budget. And in the past 3 to 5 years, so Cordova City Council has historically given pretty close to the cap, to the district. But we have found in recent years, the past 3 to 5 years, that has been somewhat lower. We've had just about $1 million less over the course of that time from the city contributions. So that has had us to make some hard decisions, either to spend down our fund balance, and that fund balance isn't always operational cash. It includes inventories and prepaid expenses as well. So, our business department gets a little bit nervous when our fund balance starts getting below a certain amount. So that certainly has been a challenge for us. Since about 2017, our health insurance costs have gone up between 15% and 20%. Our salaries and associated costs by about that same amount. And as I mentioned at the outset of the conversation, our enrollment is down a little bit. And while the whole promise provision of law protects us in some ways, it doesn't entirely hold us promise. So definitely a challenge in that. And when we look at budgeting and have budget conversations, it's really based on what our needs are and not what our wants are. And that's really a perspective that we have embraced so that we can justify and we can rationalize the requests that we're making, whether it be at the local level or whether we're sitting in committees set in front of committees such as yours testifying as to what our needs are. And we don't see our needs changing or becoming less. In fact, we see our needs increasing with, again, this year not being able to provide a pre-K program, and I'm unsure at this point as to whether we'll be able to offer a pre-K program next year. And again, we've used district resources to do our pre-K and early education programs, and we haven't had grants to be able to do that. So, really, we are putting qualified and certified teachers in front of students. So that they can best have their needs met. So it's not an easy thing for anybody, of course, and none of you say in the chat that you are having to make those decisions. But we are not slashed with money. We have needs that will continue to grow in future years. Thank you.
So,
terms of closing the schools, if the community gets the village wants to close the school, they follow that lead. If the village had certain quarantine requirements, and they're different from every village, I have a set of quarantine policies and visitation policies for every village. So we follow them and work with them to set those policies up and reinforce them with our staff. I think people in the village sometimes call me about somebody who was not on the, who's not a member of the employment staff, about something that they're doing that they don't like, and I can't do anything about that. But I certainly can enforce those policies and see if there's a deadline involved in the villages to support them and to be a true partner for them. And I will say that it's because of our villages and our main community that has made way that we've been able to do so well with our vaccine. We have 75%+ of our teaching staff are vaccinated right now. 41% of our classified staff are vaccinated. Most of that, 69%, that's also that 59% rather that are not vaccinated. We have great relationships with TCC and with ARCA, and without that, we would really be in control. So, thank you for that question, Representative
Collins. Thank you for having me. And I just wanted to reiterate that I think it's a perfect example. One size doesn't fit all. Our state is so different, and that's the point of the community. Thank you.
I'm
believe that this particular language or this amendment, while meaning, is looking to resolve an issue that does not exist. And as we see earlier in the legislation, higher up on page 2, section, it talks about that the department can issue a limited language aversion teacher certificate if the school board of the district with which the applicant is applying submits a request to the department. And so I believe that there are already safety measures in place that make a rigorous application process that will preclude world language teachers that teach languages that are not indigenous languages from being able to misuse this particular certificate type. And that's what I mean with respect to when I say I believe this is looking to resolve an issue that does not exist. So for that reason, I think it's important to simplify the language, to clarify the focus and intention of this, which is not on world languages, but instead on limited language and indigenous language learners throughout the whole field. So for that reason, I believe that this is a necessary change.
To be able to bring this open to our schools and how we're going to make it. This is from the third time that we've heard this bill. Thank you. I'm absolutely disappointed that we didn't have more public testimony, particularly for the members of our committee. Maybe we can suggest that they take a look at the archived meetings of the past because we have some really amazing testimony. Rationale for providing this kind of language teaching certificates. So I am in full support of this the sentence of the sponsor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I'm going to take a brief break.
Hey, you're talking to me.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for the testifier? No, Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Joseph, for testifying to us again. Can you describe what the high school in Woodbridge did that had an adverse effect on students?
Thank you. Good morning, Brandon Podcast.
folks. Thank you for the crisis here by your own personal struggles and now that you're here, I think it's everything. I appreciate that. Any other questions we have to do? No, okay. Well, let's move on to our panelists. Let's finish. Let's say that's all we spoke on your reading. But please give your name and place on the record and give your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Madison Spanish from Woman of the Year. And I am just 65 on behalf of myself. So I've been on the brain for about a year and a half or whatever since this started. And I feel like I've been through a journey listening to all these different tenants and the testifiers. And this has been quite a journey listening to all these testimonies today. With that in mind,
I'm
testimony?
Good morning. My name is Barbara Trudel, and I am a veteran, and I will be here for myself today.
Problems that I
in this way, I think we're doing enough. If we're giving enough consideration to that, then there's always been mental health issues. And as I reflect on my life experience, it seems like we're more successful at paying and explaining a lot of things unintentionally or whatever, but just we were more successful meeting this gap at the low level as possible. Again, I'm pretty concerned that we're a top-down approach, a one-size-fits-all approach, is going to be leading us in a different direction. Again, people with more diversified, I mean, learning from other experiences. Right now, there's people experimenting all the time on doing this, and I've got no idea, so I'm not sure we've figured it out well enough to dictate the one-size-fits-all guideline. So I need to work on it and make impact.
Actually, a couple of questions in the audience. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm
sorry. Three things that are really important to recognize about this. Well, first, this bill is not amending in any way. Actually, the goal of this bill is to give local communities as much flexibility as possible to figure out what works best in their community. And you know, I think the current guidelines that came out from the state, they leave lots of room for school districts to make their own policies, and this would be no different. And the second is that the purpose of this bill is not to try to come in with these scenarios in which comes, and there's a vote as an investment council today, and we're not doing it for students that come in to see that this is more just a throwing purpose of having a discussion that level as part of regular health courses. And it's kind of amazing to think about having going to health classes and talk about that good diet and exercise and some kind of other rich where they get regular medical checkups and I'm sure that you couldn't even talk in the beginning of the day for having some discussion about mental health and the importance of mental health. This is what this bill is about. It's not an effort to solve the problem. It's just not a text or two approach. It's a very open process to incorporate a lot of groups together for coming up with guidelines and the guidelines. And if you look at the guidelines that you're going to have for health education in the schools, they really are pretty broad and don't put them on in much of any community or any school. Did you follow?
Yes.
A more specific thing to the bill itself, the groups that were going to be involved with developing the guidelines. I believe it was Sweden suggested that the stakeholder group needs to be brought to parents and spiritual leaders. And I think this just limits, the current one is limited to, I forget the exact language here. Mental health professionals, if you will. Then we need to widen this out to include more opinions, more viewpoints.
Through the community center representative props, it's actually hard to get this message, but it's still interesting because the first version of the bill from Jim Day, we had listed more specifically a number of specific groups, National Council for Behavioral Health Problems. Services, South Central Foundation, Alaska Community Mental Health Services, North Star Behavioral Health System, National Alliance of Mental Health Services, Alaska. And we had criticism that we were both more inclusive and other inclusive, and so some groups came and said, you should be much more general in your inviting to get together and meet to try to come up with recommendations for guidelines and set the language they said we're in meeting with all of us to go to South Central. That was, that came with a suggestion from a state agency that said you should really make it pretty general so that you can be pretty broad enough to participate. And I think that there's nothing about the language that's there that there are other groups that are participating. I think there's just a lot.
representing your motion in this panel. We do want to use the questions and discussion and save the time, and we'll set this bill aside and return to those discussions at a future meeting. Our next meeting will be Monday, April 19th at 8 a.m. We will consider two bills, Senate Bill 32, College Credit for High School Students, and House Bill 132, School Apprenticeship Program.